and I hit him on a bad angle. He tripped on his own foot, face planted the table in the front row, rolled off, landed on the acoustic guitar that he had brought, smashing it.
Yo, sucker, you got a big mouth. What I'm doing, hitting money. What we doing, hitting money. They doing, hating on us, but they never cross. Cash money, still a company. Bitch, I'm the boss. Bitch, I'm paid, that's all I gotta say. Can't see you little niggas, the money in the way. And I'm sitting high against the ride blaze. And if you ain't gonna ride fly, then you might as well hate. Shit, I gotta eat, yeah, even though I ain't no one.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of Mr. Baby Podcast. This week our guest is Andy Curtin, who is not only a local stand-up here in Shanghai, but is one of the original founders of the Kung Fu Comedy Club. Comedy club here in Shanghai. Andy had some great stories of, you know, incidentally being involved in a spotlight raid on a factory. Of course, starting Kung Fu Comedy Club and how that all came to be. And some of his more interesting performances, some of which literally set the roof on fire. So enjoy these stories from Andy. And of course, check out kungfucomedy.com. That's comedy with a K. And, you know, if you're in Shanghai, of course, please go to one of their shows. Check out the club. And don't be one of those guys. You'll understand when you listen to the episode. And before we get started, I also need to mention this month on the 27th, July 27th, is the opening night of our Top 5 Series 2. Group pop culture poster show. So please check that out if you're in Shanghai. There'll be a link in the description for more information. It is also an Unraveled event, which is a storytelling show here in Shanghai. Also ask, because I always forget, please rate and subscribe if you're listening to this on iTunes or if you're listening on Shimalai or any other platform, share it. And that's it. So enjoy this episode with Andy Curtin. Here we go. Every summer, and this is how we spend money. You see them business and them lambs, the mountains and the grams. Bitch, we was born hustling. On a Yamaha, chrome down 1100. What I'm doing, hitting money. What we doing, hitting money. All right, we're here with Andy, and usually we start with just a life story. So give us a 60-second life story.
Oh, you give me a story at the beginning?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. Well, you tell your story.
Oh, my story.
Yeah, we're not going to tell our stories.
Okay.
We're going to learn about you, Andy. It's like we do 100 episodes, people have no idea who we are. We're just names.
Yeah, okay.
We can tell your life story for you if you want.
Sure, it'd probably be more interesting to tell it. You can add some stuff in that hasn't happened. I'm from Australia. I moved to China 8 years ago. And
wow, that definitely was not 60 seconds.
Yeah.
Was that? No, I didn't finish.
Oh, okay. You can talk about life before China.
You should tell people before it starts that you're gonna go, hi, tell 60 seconds about your life.
That's
Oh, okay, so gotcha. You're supposed to spring it on me. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know, I'm from Melbourne. I went to law school and then hated it, and I graduated like in the middle of 2009 when the crisis didn't really hit Australia, but they just, like, people were panicking about it, and everyone stopped hiring, and so just no one could get jobs.
Whenever people talk about the, like, recession and the crisis, I feel like 80% of it is just, like, people were just told there's a crisis, and therefore, like, a bunch of people were like, well, we can't hire right now, it's a crisis. Like,
well, I don't know what you're talking about, because I know other places where it was definitely much worse than that, but certainly for me, there just weren't any jobs.
Yeah.
So I had, like, 6 months before, I got a job in the law, and I didn't want to do it. I hated it. And I was like, in 6 months, I thought, okay, I'm just going to go to China and try and see if I can get a better job. And I did that.
Did you know anything about China?
I thought I did.
Really?
I found out pretty quickly I did not. It was.
Like, were you learning Chinese? Or it...
Yeah, but I did like a few tapes. I'm like, yeah, I got this language down.
Wow.
And then, you know, Chinese is very difficult to be understood.
Yeah.
Initially, at least. And so I kind of came here and I was like, ni hao. And people are like, what the fuck are you talking about? So
I'm kind of surprised because China is not usually people's first choice in Asia.
Well, I was at that time still kind of locked onto the whole being a person that wears suits and goes to an office job, you know, kind of had that in my head. And so I thought, like, I obsessed with languages. I really wanted to learn languages. I did Latin for like 7 years. I learned Italian and Japanese and French, but nothing really. Like, I couldn't speak. Like, in Australia, we're so far away from everything. You know, like, you could study French at, like, if you study, like, Spanish in America and you want to do it in high school, you got to be a pretty good level because there are Spanish speakers everywhere. In Australia, you'd be like, bonjour, and they're like, oh, yeah, you just top of the state, you know.
They're so impressed.
Exactly. So I was like, I want to learn a language, and I wanted to, I realized that, you know, if you go to France and learn French, it's kind of just a holiday because people speak English pretty well there. I wanted to go somewhere where if I learn a little bit of language, like, I would be able to then work a job in that language. And I feel like you had to work a job in a language if you really wanted to speak it. And I was, like, obsessed with this idea of just being able to just, like, communicate in another language. I don't know. You know, you, like, see these things and they just stay in your head. Like, there's this guy, Edward de Bono. I think he was originally an engineer or something, but he coined the expression lateral thinking. He's the guy that came up with that or made it popular anyway. Yeah. Like, he's written a bunch of books about thinking outside the box. Very famous, like, lateral thinker, which he can claim that because he made that expression up.
Yeah.
Right. And he said that, like, language is, like, the biggest tool for thinking and the greatest inhibitor.
Yeah.
And that, like, whatever language you know, it limits how you can think about stuff. And I was like, man, I want to go learn another language that's totally different, and then I can think in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of had this fantasy about it, and then I graduated, and I'm like, well, I don't like the job I'm going to, and I want to do this thing, and if I don't do it now, like, when am I going to do it? If you can't when you're graduating, you don't have kids or anything like that, if you can't do it then, I'm like, I'm never going to do it. So I just, like, did it, and I did it, like, I just, like, pulled the ripcord. Like, I woke up on a couch 24 hours after my last exam, like, oh God, what have I just done? You know, and it was kind of terrifying. I feel like, I don't know, like, Shanghai seemed like a million, I feel like going to Mars or something back then. Now it's just like nothing, but.
Well, that's like, I mean, basically what she asked you, we met so many people that were like.
That wasn't 60 seconds, by the way.
We never make it, but we met so many people that, like, oh, and then I wanted something different. So we, like, I'm going to move to China. And it's like, what? How did you choose China?
Well,
like,
so the reason I chose China is China is A, it's like a language, the language is interesting.
Yeah.
But then in the straight, like in the late 2000s, everyone's like, oh, China's a future,
really?
China, you know. And so I was like, if I fail and I come back, it'll be beneficial. Like, I'll be able to get a job out of it or something like that. So there was kind of a logical choice about it as well.
But this is like 2009, right?
Yeah.
So it's just post-Olympics, Beijing Olympics.
Right. Although I didn't really know that. Like,
oh, really?
No, I mean, if you asked me, I'd probably know. But I don't think I appreciated how significant the Olympics were to China.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, the Sydney Olympics, I would never talk about that,
right,
ever. But to this day, 10 years later, everyone still mentions the Beijing Olympics as being, because China made big changes in the lead up to it. So, and that and the expo, they were significant national occurrences.
Right.
But as a person living in Australia, I was like, yeah, you had some runners come over.
I mean, I think also it's like a lot of
congratulations, you got the Olympics.
What?
A lot of people have done the Olympics.
I mean, I feel like it did help to raise awareness because something that I've realized.
But you don't know, but I had no awareness.
As a Chinese American, that's what I'm saying. Like, I didn't realize how little understanding of China other people have.
Yeah.
But neither did I. But that's the thing about having no awareness, is you're not aware of your lack of awareness most of the time. Like, if you said you know a lot
about... That's why they're doing this.
Like, if you ask someone, people like say, I know a lot about China, and then you start talking to them, like, wow, you don't know anything about China.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't know the difference between Beijing and Shanghai.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's
and
why
they're
I'm
totally different.
I'm shocked when people are like, so I decided, like, I could probably go to China, because, like, most people I know think China is still, like, the biggest question mark of their life. Like, they know nothing about it.
Yeah,
so, just like, so the fact that there are people like, I think China might have some good jobs available, it's like, are you, like, how are you even thinking like that? Like,
well, right after the Olympics happened, there was this American-born Chinese girl who I read an interview with her because they shipped her to China to become a pop star. And she was like,
I love when you say shipped. It's like, you're going to be a pop star, so they put her in a cargo hold. on a boat.
Yeah. I feel like that story is not as...
It just sounded like it was just such a great word to choose for that. Like, I feel like if you're being put anywhere, you're being flown to be a pop star.
Yeah,
but to be shifted, it's more... I feel like that's a more honest analysis of what they're doing.
You'll get the flights once you're famous.
We're gonna put you in a box and try and sell you.
You gotta earn your dues. You start on a cargo ship and you work up to planes.
You gotta shovel the shit before you can shovel the debt.
That's what they call economy class. And she said in these interviews, she didn't know anything about China before the Beijing Olympics. And I think it was...
But what do you know after the Olympics?
Like, yeah.
They have a wall.
Beijing
is a city.
Oh, that's a place? Oh, that's like a real thing.
Do you know what the only thing that Beijing Olympics changed in Australia was everyone started saying Beijing instead of Beijing.
Wow.
That was like the huge change.
There
were newspaper articles
about
that.
Culturally,
it's a hard J.
I don't think people have seen that kind of spectacle.
Here?
No, like abroad. I mean, just like...
To have seen an Olympics?
No,
it was
like
the opening ceremony. That's what I feel like. Opening ceremony was the biggest stamp of that Olympics, because it was like, oh my God, they have 1,000 drummers drumming in unison. It's like, yeah, because they're slave people. They're not
Well, I mean,
like,
they do it every
that's what I mean.
New
it's
Year. Like,
it's
not uncommon if you are from here.
Yeah.
But like, for other countries, I feel it was like...
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually, because one of the, you know, the volumes of things here... You get kind of desensitized to it after a while. But I remember like the first time I walked out at People's Square and it was like, whoa, I've never seen anything like this. Like, it just hit me.
Just like that number of people? Or...
Yeah, I know. And I walked out. I remember I was going to see an apartment and I walked out of People's Square station and it just suddenly I was surrounded by huge neon buildings, which I'd never seen before. I mean, I've traveled a lot, but I guess I'd never been anywhere like that. And suddenly I was like, whoa, this is new. And then there was just people as far as I could see. And I'm just like, okay, I think I'm in China now. You know what's really funny? I lived in that area for 3 years. And it was on Xinchanglu, which is like Xinchanglu, Xinjialu. I don't know, like Xinjialu Station. So basically you go from People's Square, which is really busy and full of people. And then you walk down a street where the lights are a little bit dimmer.
Yeah.
And I walked all the way to the elevated highway. And I was like, oh, I'm on the outskirts of the city now. I don't want to live here. I was like, I don't want to live out in the boondocks.
Yeah.
I was a 5-minute walk from the center of town, from like the center of the universe. But because the lighting was a little lower, I was like, oh, God, I'm going to be stuck on the edge of it, like out in the sticks now. I just, so sensory,
had no
overwhelmed, you know, my perspective was just shot to pieces.
Yeah. Growing up in Australia... Was the area you were in, like, pretty suburban or rural?
I don't know if I ever grew up there. I grew up, like, you know, Melbourne is suburbs. It's, like, a sprawled city. People say it's similar to L.A. In the sense that it's, like, you know, you don't live in the city.
Yeah.
Like, only
There's
Chinese
like a downtown,
people live in the city.
Yeah.
It's, seriously, it's, like, that's, like, the CBD, you know. You can walk from one side to the other in 20 minutes. And then the rest of it's just kind of like suburbs.
Yeah.
So I grew up in the suburbs, not far from downtown. City.
So after you came to China, and you hit the ground, big wide eyes, where'd you go from there?
What did you think you were going to do?
Yeah, with the language, you just
take
wanted
over
to
the
learn
world,
the language.
You know? I think I told some guy, I was like, I'm going to learn the language. I'll be fluent in 6 months. And I want to get a really good job in finance. He just started laughing at me, and I'm like, I'm going to show this guy. And I did not show him anything.
So you weren't necessarily done with, like, law and business.
I worked as a financial journalist for a while, and then I got a job working in corporate finance. And it was pretty crazy. That's kind of a whole nother story. But basically, this huge Swedish consumer goods company had bought cardboard box factories all over China and Asia, mostly in China. And they had this just retarded strategy of buying out family-owned cardboard box factories and then keeping the families to run them. And they were just... Everyone was stealing from them. Everyone. All the families were stealing from them. It was just... And everyone's like, who told you to do this? That was the most obvious thing that would happen.
I feel like that actually happens quite often. Maybe not here, but like that's not a weird business plan. Like, kind of buy people out, but keep them.
It's a stupid business plan in this country. If you're not going to be there,
to have
controls and stuff like that. So what they did was, they didn't even tell me this. They just hired me. And I got hired and put in this like crack team of auditors from like big four accounting firms. I didn't know that they were there to catch these people. So I just got sent out to factories all across China and we're checking all the numbers. And I didn't have a background in accounting. So I'm just like, we're just checking things and just finding errors. And then one day our boss comes in, he's like, we got enough. We're going to go and put him in jail. I'm like, what? So they sent us down to Guangzhou. We were given a personal ex-special forces security guard each, march into this factory, and we just start holding people in offices and putting them in. The police come, put them in jail, take them out of jail. It was insane. I'm going through people's desks and finding bank accounts with millions of RMB stored in Macau and stuff like that. And, it was super exciting. I'm like a little adventure, And I had a translator, and I'm like grabbing people and interrogating, but I didn't really even know how this business worked, right? So I was like interrogating one lady, and I said to my boss, I'm like, this lady, she's been stealing, I'm going to catch her. He comes in, talks to her for like 10 minutes. He's like, no, that's actually her job. That's what she's supposed to do. And I was like, oh, okay.
She's been counting.
Yeah, right? I'm like, she's been counting the money that goes to the bank. No. And then because they were worried about our safety, because some of these guys, they were local, like they had thugs and stuff like that, so they were keeping us in this 5-star hotel in the middle of a zoo, and I would get up in the morning and I was the only foreigner, most people in my team spoke some English, I didn't really speak Chinese, and I was getting up and every morning I would eat breakfast next to a glass window with a white tiger just sitting there, and I'm like, what is going on, like what planet am I living on?
How far into China are you at
that was like 6 months in, I think.
If you had such a strong reaction to Shanghai, what did you think of Guangzhou?
I didn't like it, I mean, we didn't see the fun part of it. I mean, it was interesting.
Tigers
were
the fun part.
Well, I mean, it was fun. Like, I enjoyed the adventure of it, but I wasn't like, ooh, I want to live there, It wasn't like it wasn't that kind of exciting. It's like Beijing. I really don't like Beijing. Anything about it, but I think that it's good to see, and be like, oh, never want to live there. And everyone who lives in Beijing tries to convince you that it's such a great place to live. I'm like, then why does no one live there for more than 3 years? People live in Shanghai, live here for 10, 15 years. I know almost no one that's lived in Beijing for that long.
Yeah, I don't know anything about Beijing.
People, they're like, oh, that was really cool if you, on a Tuesday, one day a year, there's this place that squeezes their own grape. I'm like, what are you talking about? That sounds horrible. That's the most exciting thing.
They're just trying to make the best of a bad situation.
Right,
I think because it's larger, there's much more subculture there. So, you have to, travel really far, but then you find these little pockets of groups that do that kind of stuff.
Sure, but so the way that it was explained to me is that there's so much government property underground there that they couldn't put the subway in easily. So the subway stations are really
horrible,
terribly placed. So that's problem A. Problem B is that they did this whole Pudong thing where they're like, we want wide roads. So it's impossible to walk. Everywhere is really far to walk. It takes you 10 minutes across the street. Then, because of the security risk with the government buildings, they couldn't put in an elevated highway, so the traffic is terrible.
Yeah.
And then the cab drivers are all assholes. So just getting anywhere. So you say, oh, but if you go really far and you find this pocket, I'm like, I want to kill myself by the time I get there.
I didn't make it to the cab, let alone to the destination.
Have you heard of those underground bunker tours?
No.
I don't think they do them anymore. I think it was only for a couple of
years. Gee, I can't imagine why they shut that down.
But there was a museum where you could go down into one of these bomb shelters. I think a lot of them have been transformed into underground malls at this point. But I mean,
that's so China.
They're wide enough to fit two Mack trucks next to each other.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's it's fully outfitted. There's hospitals and all kinds of different storerooms and stuff down there. Plus, these old, like, Mao murals.
Why did people stop fearing nuclear apocalypse? Like, why did they just stop fearing that? Right, that's the whole thing, right? Remember they just had bunkers everywhere, you know? People in the 70s and 60s, they're like, well, someone's going to drop a bomb.
They didn't know. They thought the bomb was going to be dropped on them at any minute.
Yeah, but did that change?
Yeah, I think people were able to find out that was a lot of, like, propaganda. And,
ooh, you know. I don't know about that.
Depends where you are, I guess. But, yeah, that is a weird thing here is, like, there's a lot of basements that look like basements. And then you start to realize, like, oh, a lot of these doorways are, like, rounded. And they're very, like, bomb shelter.
Yeah, the shelter. Like, oh, this is the really shelter was a shelter.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that stuff. Don't get me wrong. I love that. But I'm not going to hang out at the museum every weekend. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you never know. I mean, in Paris, they have museums of the original sewer system. And people take those all the time.
Oh,
yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting part. But I think it's just interesting that they're able to, like, repurpose them. Like, there's a coding school here that was, like, it's called Code Bunker. And I, like, went there for, like, the first time I went there. It's like, oh, that's an interesting name. And then you get there, you go downstairs, it's like this giant fucking door. It's like, oh, this is a bunker. Like, they bought a bunker.
They're like, sorry, the name is a bit confusing because we don't do any coding.
Yeah. But then you'll go to other basements.
Yeah, it just has a code on the door. This is just a bunker.
Yeah.
You can never leave.
I told Beryl this before. My favorite thing about them is not even that they're bunkers, but there's this old, it's not old, but Beastie Boys video, I think, I don't remember which song it is, but there's, like, in the video, their practice base, they, like, go into this basement, it's, like, in New York, it's, like, the fifth basement under a Chinese restaurant.
Hey, I love that stuff, I'm not, like,
and it's just, like, I don't know, I always see those, I'm like, God, where are these places? Like, when you hear about people who had, like, they rented an art studio that's, like, the third basement in Chinatown, well, it's, like, how do you even find out about this shit?
Yeah.
It's, like, just the, like, that looks so cool, and then, like, when I go to these bunkers, it's, like, oh, my God. This is that. Like, there's a gallery or basement six, and it's, like, to get there, you, like, go in this, like, little side door next to this, like, front door of the building.
It's a residential.
You have to make a bird sound.
Yeah, and it just goes in this, like,
on the hour.
Sketchy concrete, like, basement that is, like, Chinese people living. Like, these rooms with, like, you've seen them, I'm sure, it's, like, the room can only fit a bed and a TV, and, like, it's like, who is living here? It's, like, some old Chinese lady, and then you go around the corner, then there's, like, another door, and then you go down those steps, and then it's, like, a third basement. It's just, like, this, like...
Oh, man, I love that stuff.
This place?
I remember I was, I did, like, a huge backpacking trip across Eastern Europe years ago. I mean, it must have been, like, 10 years ago. And, you know, I was in, like, Vienna in the middle of the winter, and I was kind of lonely and traveling by myself. And then I just hooked up with a couple of cool people, and they were like, come on, let's go to Prague. Got on the train there, and, you know, I finally went from, like, super depressed, minus 16 degrees, to suddenly I had these friends, you know, two girls from Brazil, this guy from Montreal, and we're drinking wine on the train. And then we get out of Prague, and it's snowing, and I'm from Melbourne, so I haven't really seen that much snow. I mean, there's snow in Australia, but I haven't seen that much of it. And it was, like, pounding. It was like being in a snow globe after someone had shaken it up, and I'm just like, immediately when I see snow, I'm like a 3-year-old. Doesn't matter what day it is. I'm skipping, you know, just insanely, I just lose my shit. Yeah. I just turn into a kid.
We talk about this all the time when you meet people who have never seen snow or, like, whenever they come to New York.
Even though I've seen it now, I still...
But it's like they come to New York and they're like, oh my God, it's snowing.
Oh, dude,
I'm so excited. It's like, I'll give you 24 hours before you're fucking miserable.
Nah,
dude. It's cold. And then as soon as you have to, here's the thing, a weekend, enjoy it. If it's a work day, as soon as you need to do anything... Good fucking luck.
I don't know. I was in New York during a blizzard in 2009, and I think I came in my pants a couple of times. It was pretty incredible.
Did you have to, like, go to work, though, or, like, do regular activities?
No.
Like, especially in New York, it's like, there's no drainage, so everything is, like, these snow mounds that lead into, like, foot-deep puddles. After a day, all the nice white snow has now turned to brown ice, like, mush. It's just, like...
Well, the point of that story, though, was, like, so we arrived in this backpackers in, like, the middle of Prague somewhere, and then the guy, we said to the guy, they were like, oh, is there somewhere cool to drink around here? And he's like, wow, there's the bar out the front is really cool. And we go in there, and it's, like, this shoebox bar. There's, like, three fat guys sitting at the bar and taking up half the room. And we're like, why did he send us here? And the bartender just, like, points to the back of the room, and there's just, like, a narrow door, and then, like, a rounded stairwell with, like, you know, brick. And suddenly there was this huge network all the way under that whole block. Like, you'd be in one bar, and you're like, hey, there's a doorway over there, and you go through a tunnel, and there's another bar. There were, like, hundreds of people down there.
Nice.
Yeah. God forbid there was ever a fire. Yeah. God forbid one of those guys in the bar, like, dropped his cigarette. That was amazing. Yeah. I mean, I love that stuff.
Did you have that moment of going through the first stairwell of just like, okay, we don't know what's here. We might die right now.
No. It was very much like Alice in Wonderland. You know, I was chasing the rabbit at that point.
I'd be more afraid, like, if I got drunk, I would never find my way out of there. I'd just be like, I live here now.
Well, I guess this is my family.
My brother used to live in Dubai. He worked there. And we came to visit him once.
That's a dark place.
It's a very interesting place from what I heard. It's like, but it's so similar to here, like, depending on who the person is, like, you can introduce people to, like a bootleg market. They have, like, a ton of that. So he's like, oh, do you guys want to, like, go buy some shit? And I was at high school. I was like, yeah, sure. Like, I'm going to get a big fake, like, Rolex or something, like a big watch. So we went to this market. And they have, like, a couple stores that have a few things out. And then, like, you know, there's the real secret stuff, like the good shit. And it's just, like, guys in the hallways of these malls. And it's like, oh, I can bring you the good thing. We're like, oh, we want this. Like, big face watches. Like, something, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, okay, yeah. And it's like me and my two brothers. And he's like, oh, go into this room. And we go into this, like, store that's, like, empty. It's just, like, shit in bags. It's like when it looks like a retail store that hasn't been set up. And that has, like, a back door, like a hidden back door that led to a staircase. So we go, like, halfway up the staircase. Then that staircase on the wall is a second, like, hidden door. It's, like, all these kind of, like, back alleys.
And that was just the bathroom.
Yeah, and then it's, like, and by the second or third door, me and my brother's like, so, like, should we get ready for trouble? We don't know where we're going. We eventually are in this, like, attic, this bizarre attic where basically they just stored everything. And the counter's, like, it's like this glass counter that opens up. It's all these watches. And at first we were, like, really sketched out because now we're, like, we don't know where we are. And, like, this guy is kind of shifty. And there's, like, another guy. And we're like, who's that guy? And then we realize, like, we have nothing to worry about. Like, that other guy is there because these are two, like, Middle Eastern guys who are not very big. They're, like, 130, 140. And we are three huge American guys. It's like, oh, they're terrified of us.
Oh, that's right.
like, we started to realize, like, oh, we should not be terrified. This guy is like,
we should rob these guys.
Yeah, like the three of us are like, we're going to take all this. Like, oh, yeah, they're afraid of us. So.
Like, here's what's going to happen.
I'm going to take all these Louis Vuitton bags here.
Take off your watch.
So, then you're in Australia, in Shanghai. When did you make the leap? Because we haven't mentioned yet, you are stand-up comedian. And so how did you make this leap from finance and law to being an entertainer?
You know, it kind of happened, like, organically, I guess. Yeah. I mean, in the sense of the way it developed, I just, someone had said to me years ago, they're like, oh, you should try doing stand-up. And I don't know, you're probably about my age, you know, delirious and raw. Like, I think everyone my age watched these movies as kids. Eddie Murphy... August 1983 put out, like, one of the best comedy albums of all time. Mm. And it just, you know, it was one of those things that was just in my head for years. I didn't really think about it that much, but it was, it certainly had a huge impact on me. And then I just kind of wanted to try it. And I was doing finance, and I'm just, like, doing Excel all day. And I was doing my CFA, which is a really difficult exam. It's kind of like an MBA for finance people. And I was just losing my shit, just using one side of my brain. And I just like, I gotta get out of the office and do something different. And so I just was like, I'm gonna do stand up. I'm gonna try and do stand up. And they didn't have it here, really. I mean, there was a British guy bringing through, like, British comedians, mm-hmm. like, once every 6 months or something. There's nothing local. So I went to an open mic for, like, poetry and stuff, and I just did stand up.
Just like a coffee house open mic.
Yeah, it was a jazz bar, okay. Blue Note or something like that. It was on. I think Raging Lou, maybe, or Sinanlu. Yeah. And I just did my set, and then I realized at that time, I was like, so this works way better. These people need to be here for comedy. You can't trick. I learned my first show. I did all right, actually. You know what I remember? It's all my jokes about the expo. which kind of dates it a little bit. Hilarious. Yeah, yeah. And they were funny. You wouldn't get it now because the expo's gone, but they were a killer. And so I was like, I got to do this again, but I need to do it where it's like people are here to watch comedy. And, you know, there's a lot of non-native English speakers or non-English speakers there as well. So I got a bunch of people I thought were funny together. And I was like, why don't everyone write like 5 minutes of jokes? And then I convinced a bar, Beatty's on Darkaloo, who didn't have a lot of business. I was like, can we just use your mic for an hour? And then, you know, we were so nervous, we didn't even invite an audience. We just did it to each other. I'm like, this is great. You should bring other people, you know, pretty much, you know, just like 8 people sitting around and trying to tell jokes, really. And then, so we were like, okay, we made a poster and we put it on, you know, all the websites, and they were pretty big on it because there was nothing like that yet. And it just blew up. It was, I mean, the bar could hold 50 people and I think 100 people rocked up. So there's all the people out in the street that couldn't get in, and then the sound system broke as we were beginning, so no one even like heard the stand up.
What year was this around?
2000. It was the beginning of 2011.
Okay.
Previous to this, did you have any stage experience or theater?
I played music for years. I was a trumpet player for 13 years. Okay. So I'd done a lot of music, but not like vocal performance, I guess. And so, you know, I missed that, I guess, a little bit. I don't know. I had a weird relationship with it because I'd started at a really young age and been in really intense programs, so I didn't have a love for it. I probably could have appreciated it more now as someone that has nothing. that I was good at something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so people were like, oh, when's the next one? We're like, next one? next month, I guess. And so we started doing it once a month, and it was just packing out every week. Then we started doing open mics, and then I connected with the guy who became my good close friend and business partner, Turner Sparks. He was doing a similar thing in Suzhou. He said, why don't you guys come to Suzhou? We'll come to Shanghai.
Yeah.
Then we started doing shows in Wuxi. We've done shows in 30 different cities in China.
Yeah.
So we moved around a lot after that, and it just had the wind in its sails.
This was just all under the banner of Kung Fu Comedy?
Yeah, I mean, we just gave it the name at the beginning, and then Turner adopted that name because it was better than the name. He liked it more than the name he was using.
Yeah.
So it made sense to just, you know, we're going to put it together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have one name. And, yeah, I don't know, the name Kung Fu Comedy, it's easy to remember. I think that's a big part of it. And it's got a bit of China in it. Although Chinese people always come to the shows and they're like, we love the show, but where is the Kung Fu? You know? Okay, it's just the name. Were you disappointed? I didn't hit anyone. That's like that's your note.
Has the audience always been primarily expat?
Well, initially it was,
mm-hmm.
and then you know because expats, actually the thing about stand up is people think it's really mainstream and it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much an alternative art form. It's very known, but not many people have seen it. Like, way less than you'd think.
Yeah.
Even amongst Americans and other countries that have a lot of stand-up. So foreigners were coming in kind of knowing what it was, and then the Chinese audience was less familiar with it. But then at that time, you had more and more educated Chinese people moving back to China, and they might have lived in New York and gone to a comedy show and been interested in it. And so we had this slow burning. So whereas our foreign audience was leaving every 6 to 12 months, you know, you had to work really, you're working against the rate of people leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Chinese audience was just building. And so now,
regulars.
Right. So now we have Chinese, you know, shows will be 40-60% Chinese in the audience. And then we have Chinese shows, which are 100% Chinese audience.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Maybe like 99%. You know, there's always one white guy sitting in there like, oh, is this all in Chinese?
They came to the wrong one.
Or they come in and like,
they
I'm always like...
on the poster and they're like, oh, that was like fun.
Every time.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God. Okay, so Dashan is like, he's a Canadian guy who is famous for, if you heard him on the radio, you would not think that he's white.
Yeah.
His Chinese is really incredible, yeah.
And he's done a ton of, like, entertainment and press before.
He's quite famous, right?
He's quite famous.
He's hugely famous, yeah. And he's also, he doesn't just speak Chinese, but he performs xiangsheng, which is, you know, traditional Chinese comedy, at a level that no other white person has ever even come close to achieving. He was doing in, like, the late 80s. He was already at that level.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's super advanced in at that. And yeah, people come and they're like, "Ah, oh, I didn't." But even some of the Chinese audience are like, "He's performing in Chinese." We're like, "He only speaks in Chinese. Have you ever heard him speak English?" You know,
yeah.
Which is fine. We try to be as clear about it as possible. But then you always get these like kind of overconfident foreigners coming in, being like, "I can understand it." I'm like, "Dude, I perform it and I can't understand it." Yeah. So, good luck. And then 10 minutes in, they're just staring at their phone. You know,
yeah.
And then they're like, oh, I'm like, did you enjoy it? They're like, I enjoyed it. I'm like, you sat there staring at your phone the whole time, champ.
How did awesome. You link up with him?
I met Darshan. So there was a guy named Des Bishop who was he's like a household Irish name in comedy and kind of known a little bit in England and Australia. And he does these TV shows. So he filmed a TV show where for 2 years he learnt Mandarin with the goal of performing stand up in Mandarin. So he was living in Beijing at the time doing this thing, and Darshan, he's sort of, you know, about half the year in Beijing. And so they kind of met, and then Des said to him, he was like, why don't you come to an open mic? Just come in, we won't announce it, you can just try it. And stand up is a drug, not everyone gets addicted to it, but if it gets its teeth in you, it's really hard to stay away from it. And
I've heard a lot of stories of like, you go up and if you bomb and you still want
to
do it,
that's really true. To me, that's a real big difference, you know, because you get a lot of people, they come into the club and they're really bright eyed and they come in, they're like, I know that I want to be a professional comedian. I'm like, get up and bomb 5 times. And if you still want to come back after that, I'll spend some time on it.
Yeah.
Because that's the real difference. If you want to do stand up when it feels good, you're not going to do it for very long. And if you sort of have that like sadomasochistic level of enjoyment, even when it's horrible, then you can't stay away from it. So he really got hooked on it. And then, because he had this huge name, it was really easy to sell tickets to shows that he was on. Mm-hmm. So Des said to me, can you bring this guy down, and put on a show? And I was like, yeah, that's great. And we very quickly became close friends. You know, I did an interview with him. I think it might've been the first night that I met him, and it's online now. And I'd never done an interview before. It's horrible. Like, I'm so out of it.
Yeah.
But I've interviewed him, I think like 5 times now. So we just got hooked into that. And then he was kept doing stand up and we were doing Chinese shows together. And then more recently, I got him into the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, which is the first time they've ever had a big stage Chinese language show at an international comedy festival anywhere in the world. And so I produced that show. And so I had him and his wife living at my parents' house for like 3 weeks.
Oh, you did those shows. Chinese show down there.
Yeah. Because I was running it, I did a 2 week run of an English show about China with Shanghai comedian Storm Shu, who's a good friend of mine.
This is very recently.
This is this year. Yeah, yeah. And then Storm hosted Darshan's show at the Forum Theatre, which is like a famous old theatre in Melbourne. So we've just been doing stuff, you know, ongoing the whole time. Yeah.
At what point did you start bringing in comedians from abroad?
18 months after we started, so like middle of 2012. I hated my job. I just had this terrible boss. Like, he was a horrible human. Just a horrid, horrid human, you know. And he was just torturing everyone in his office. And I was just hating every day. And I had to quit. I just had to quit. And I got out of there. And I was going to leave. And my buddy Turner was like, why don't we just try and bring a comedian in and run them through these shows? And he was like, it might be a business. And I was like, my logic was, I'm just going to do something cool so I don't leave on a bad note. Like, I just want to do something that I can be proud of before I leave.
You thought your time in China was just
done. Yeah, I was like, I want to leave on this down note. And we did it, and it was a lot of fun. And then I couldn't find another job. And I was like, all right, well, let's just do another one. And we did 2 more that year. And I was like, but at that stage, I thought, you know, this is pretty cool. I want to keep doing this. And
are you making enough to like live off of?
Not really. But there's that promise. I mean, small business, man. It's such a lot of shit, you know? But everyone's like, I'm going to be a billionaire, you know? But really, you just barely make enough to get by. But you have this hope that it's going to turn into... It's like when you work... If you take a job with someone and they don't pay you enough money, you have this... It affects your sense of worth. You know, you feel like your life isn't getting any better. But if you're working for yourself and you're not making enough money, you can lie to yourself and see that it's going to be more eventually, even though statistically that's incredibly unlikely.
Yeah, we've actually had, by no plan of ours, but we've kind of turned into this, like, entrepreneur podcast. Like, everyone here, a bunch of our guests have started their own
thing. Wow, that sounds depressing as fuck.
Well, no,
I don't know anyone in China that has
Well, it's like total coincidence, because it's just like...
It does have a startup. You don't know anyone?
No, everyone.
We do. Like, everyone we've interviewed, like, that's their story. It's like, I started my own thing. And it's like, not on purpose, but we've just like, 9 out of 10 of our guests are like entrepreneurs.
Well, I think the crowd in Shanghai, or maybe just in China in general, is like, very self-selecting. The way that it is for any country. I mean, for example, like, we did study abroad in Tokyo, and then like, 50% of those kids were anime. Another like, 40%, they were looking for a karate dojo.
Wow.
You have like, you know, a lot of like a big percentage of people who are just looking for a Japanese boyfriend, girlfriend, right? So like that's that crowd, right? And I'm sure if you go to like, if you go to France, if you go to England, I mean, those are like a very specific set of people. Same with people who come to New York, I think. And with Shanghai. That's
the parallel between Shanghai and New York, right?
Sort of. I think it's much more challenging in Shanghai than it is in New York. I think that you need to be a very specific kind of crazy in order to survive here. Would you disagree?
I've never lived in New York.
Okay. I mean, well, I feel like
it's just
like,
a different... I mean, there's like, obviously people go there for business, but it's if you go not to like New- a big hope and dream. Like, the hope and dream is like the acting.
Yeah.
I think that a foreigner moving to China is more likely... Shanghai is more likely to start their own thing than in New York. Probably, yeah. That's true.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's an unprecedented level of shit that expats deal with here on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's...
Either you know, have this tough skin for it, or you don't.
Sure. Or you're an idiot.
Yeah.
And you convince yourself
that you're different from
every story you've ever heard.
I guess the barrier to get things started here is just a little bit easier to, like... I mean, not saying no, it doesn't get tough, but it's just that starting, like...
Yeah, it requires less investment to start things here, usually. And that is, like, a big obstacle. Because most people, when they're starting their first thing, they don't know how to get money. Yeah. And they also... It's hard to get money when it's your first thing.
Yeah.
When you first started Kung Fu Comedy, were you just bouncing around to different bars?
Yeah, and I thought that was the right thing to do, and it wasn't. You know, I found out that was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Because now you guys have your own space.
Yeah, there was a point where I was like, okay, having your own place, that's the way to do it. Because when you have your... Like, people don't realize this, but, like, that, you know, stand-up shows are very simple in terms of their equipment requirements, but the layout of the room has this huge effect on the quality of the show.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in a loud bar and there's TVs on and there's an open window to the street, like, all these things will ruin a show.
Yeah.
Like, when the people on stage have to compete with distractions, ruins the show. And when you're setting up your show in other people's bars, you're not only having to make the best of a room that isn't set up properly, you're also competing with another business that's already in that room trying to do business.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got, like, Chinese bar staff blending margaritas when doing a punchline, and it's like you're ruining the show. That's bad for business, but they don't have that that long view on it.
Yeah.
Most people, because they're trying to make their rent, you know, and they got their own pressures. So, you know, there was one stage where I was doing a show, and you know, each week we'd be in Jinchao and then Hongqiao, and then, you know, downtown, and then there was just not many people in any of the shows, and then the show quality was terrible, and then all the comedians are demoralized. And then when you have your own venue, people will come to you. It's kind of like the Field of Dreams, you know, to quote Kevin Costner, I think. The great Kevin Costner.
Well, I think there is a weird, like, to that, just, I mean, even if you do a regular event...
Yeah, people know.
Even,
that's
even
the thing.
There's regulars, like, you still have to, like, find the event, go to the event, but just having your own space, like, people know it's a place where it is.
Well, it's really hard to have
regular.
It's really hard to have a full schedule. That's really hard. People don't realize that, like, there is a million years difference between running an event once a month and running five a week.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a totally different game. you have to have a totally different strategy. And adding shows sucks the life out of your other shows, not just on the audience draw, but the perception that you can just go anytime you want.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other side of it is when you have enough momentum, like we've been able to achieve, people just come not knowing what's going to be on, knowing that there'll be something on that they can enjoy. And that's a really...
It almost just becomes like a bar, like a place people go.
Well, it, become, a bar, but like, it becomes... A, it, yeah. It's like if you're going to go to go-karting or something, you don't you don't have to look at the go-karting website to see if there's an event on where you can drive a go-kart. You're like, fuck it, let's go go-karting. And you just go and it's going to be there. You know, and that's what we've tried to achieve. And I think we have to an extent.
I mean, I think that you guys have really succeeded in building that scene. I mean, do you ever feel like you're hurting for performers, or are you kind of suffering from too many people?
I think that we don't... I mean, you know, I think that having depth of talent is an important thing. Like, we've done very well. The problem for us has been that, like, is that when guys get really good... There are 10 people living in New York that started comedy here, doing comedy full-time.
Yeah.
Like, we get people to a professional level, and then they have to go somewhere where they can be, have a real shot at being a professional. And that's kind of tough, you know. Like, last year in June, I think, you know, four of the headliners from here all left within, like, 2 months of each other. It just gutted our whole lineup.
Yeah.
And for months, the quality of our shows went down a lot.
Are they all holed up in a studio in New York now?
They are, yeah. No, they're not in the same place, but they're all like, they're like this sad bunch of lost children, you know. But they have, but you know what they're holed up in is they're holed up in the same venues. Like, they've managed to finagle relationships to get into the same club. So there's one club that they stay, and they run Kung Fu Comedy shows in New York. We have Kung Fu Comedy shows in New York.
Nice.
All the time. And so the guys that headline, when I fly someone out from the US to come here, they will headline Kung Fu Comedy show in New York as well. Which is kind of a cool network that we've set up. So like Storm has just gone and done a month of shows in New York, and he's got all these rooms he can play through the network that we've built up.
Is Storm doing Chinese shows in New York?
No, just English.
When you bring people over, have you built up enough that you kind of like people know you as a booker, or is it just like you find comedians who are going to be here, or do you actually bring people, like invite people?
You know, we are pretty lucky now in that we're very well known in outside of China
as a
venue for comedy, and the acts that we get, they're way above that. the acts that we book are way beyond what you should expect to be able to get in a room this size. Mm-hmm. Because these guys, they just want to see China. They just want to see China.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, like, the nice thing is once you build the momentum, now, like, in the American, like, LA or New York comedy community, I would assume it'd be like, oh, you're going to China? You should do a show there. Like, oh, they do shows there. Like, yeah, you know, the people are just
people
here
know,
on vacation.
People know there's, and it's not just China, you know. There's a scene in Hong Kong and Taiwan and KL and... You know, Korea, there's, you know, I gig every month. I go outside of China and gig around Asia. I'll headline somewhere around Asia. And so, to answer your question, we're now at a point where I'm only bringing out, I mean, I don't know, maybe 15, 16 guys a year. Yeah. So if I book someone, I already know who they are.
Yeah.
I'm targeting people that I want to get and talking to people. And, you know, someone be like, hey, so-and-so is interested. And I know, I want them, you know, they're great. And so we're able to book at a level... Like, I, the rate at which I'm booking is slow enough that I can be really opportunistic about it. And I'm super excited about everyone. Like, we've got crazy acts coming out.
Yeah.
Like, next month we have Zainab Johnson, who's just this amazing black female comedian from the US who's just blowing up. She's going to be huge. Next month, Mark Normand, who's Louis C.K. and Amy Schumer's opener, he's going to be huge. Like, in 2 years' time, he'll be a massive name. Ahmed, who's from the Axis of Evil tour. Yeah. I've got Nazim Hussain, who's one of the biggest comedians in Australia. He's coming out. These guys play theaters everywhere else, you know.
Last year you had Eddie Izzard, right?
Eddie Izzard was this year, yeah. And we had Russell Howard, who's like one of the biggest guys in England these days.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually, because you guys set him up at Mercedes-Benz or something.
Yeah, yeah, in the mixing room.
How did that come about?
The venue... How did we get that venue? Or I mean, I know there's not that many venues in Shanghai. Like, I've communicated with pretty much all of them, I think, from the range of, like, 1,000 to, you know, up from there. Mercedes-Benz Arena is run by AEG, and so when you're dealing with that versus like Ehi Theater, where we had Russell Howard, which is state owned, you know, it's like a dream. They're so professional, they know what they're doing and everything. And so I just messaged the guy, I'm like, is this date available? And that was pretty much it. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
So I guess we can start telling some stories. You said you had some good, well, performing stories, good or bad.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's doing, you kind of, the crazy stories I feel like being here, when you go out on the road and you don't really, you're in a Mexican restaurant, some Chinese city you've never heard of, and the expats out there are lost people, you know. Yeah, one good one we had, we used to do shows in this Mexican restaurant in Kunshan, which is a city halfway between Suzhou and Shanghai. It's technically part of Suzhou, but I think what's most interesting about it is that it has nothing good going for it that isn't in Suzhou and Shanghai in a better form.
Yeah.
So, which begs the question, why would you live there? You're not in rural China. You're in a city. You're in a huge city. It's nowhere near as good as places that are a half hour away. Why would you live here? No one's been able to answer that question. But
cheaper?
Nah.
What?
Nah, I don't think so. Maybe a slightly bigger apartment.
Oh, but I thought it was maybe like, I got a deal on this like apartment complex and I never seen the place, but just moved in.
Nice. I really don't know why people live there. Yeah, yeah. So we go there and it's just mayhem. You know, I was hosting, someone vomited on me while I was hosting. And I walked off, just threw up on my leg, you know. And people are losing their shit. One guy's lying under a table.
Yeah.
And the host is like, I was hosting someone else, Drew Freilich, was said to the guy, he's like, man, this is actually an intervention. And everyone's like, he does this every night. And then at the end of the show, the roof caught on fire. The roof caught on fire and no one reacted. And all the comics are like, there are flames inside the roof and there's smoke right now. And everyone's just like holding a pint, looked up like, you catch fire every now and then, you know. Whoosh ran it. We're all standing there with our bags, you know, our mic stand just outside the building, like we're about to watch 50 expats get melted onto the taco covered floor of this Mexican restaurant.
He does that every night. He pukes, then he'll light a fire.
Totally. And... Yeah. There was a lot of that. There was like these chaotic things where you're in your brain, you're like, this is going to go really badly. And then no one, it's like being in a dream or something. You're like, you guys not?
Tell some jokes.
Yeah. They're like, be funny. I'm like, you're going to die. Like, that shit on the roof, it's like, there's black smoke inside the venue. And then everything looked flammable as well.
Oh, God.
You know.
I guess that wasn't an asbestos building.
No, asbestos isn't flammable. Asbestos is not flammable.
That's the point of it. It stops
flaming. Yeah.
It's
just poison.
Yeah. Usually people complain about having asbestos in the building.
Right, that's when you want it. Problem. Yeah. I'm like, God damn it. Why didn't they make this thing out of asbestos? We'd all be alive still. Or at least dying on a much slower level.
Save the tacos!
They had asbestos tacos, if that makes you feel better. Oh. I had my family has had a house outside of Melbourne since like the late 50s, early 50s, and mid 50s. Anyway, so in Australia there was this huge court case where the tides had turned on asbestos, you know, around the world, and this company that it's called James Hardie was the company. Had built asbestos houses everywhere, and there was this huge class action of all these people with emphysema suing. And so everyone knew the name James Hardie because of this class action, right? So that house that we had was a display home for the worst type of asbestos, and the Hardie family had lived in it. The actual James Hardie had lived in it after they'd, you know, finished using it as a display home and sold it to us. And we didn't knock it down until like 3 years ago. We've been going there like our whole lives. So
it's your asbestos museum.
And what they said, like, it's so funny. Like the builders were like thinking we would be impressed as they discovered like how bad the quality of asbestos that was used. They're like, this in your bathroom, like this will kill you in a second, you know.
Like, we know.
This is blue. They were like, this is blue asbestos. We didn't even know they still had this. anyway.
First generation of asbestos.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty funny.
Sort of related. My mom, when I was growing up, when I was really little, she was a lawyer for the city, and she defended the city in lead paint cases. So if somebody's kid ingested lead paint in, like, a city-owned building, then they would sue, and she would defend them. But the irony was that we lived in an apartment that was covered in chipping lead paint.
Oh, so wow.
That was, like, a big, like, inside joke for all of our family. And
yeah, friends. Your mom's going to tan on you.
They'd come over and they'd be like, Beryl, how those lead paint chips taste? And I'd be like, I don't know, tastes pretty sweet to me.
That's great.
I was, like, 5 years old. I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have the appreciation of the dynamic. That is funny.
So in addition to comedy here, you also started a Kung Fu comedy podcast.
I did, yeah.
A little bit of a network, right? You had a couple going at one time.
Yeah, yeah. Well I was... Because I kind of figured out the ropes on producing podcasts. We did... So actually, Stuck in the Middle wasn't the first one. We did another one. I can't even remember the name of the podcast. It was 5 or 6 years ago now, but it was really cool. We had some really interesting guests from around China, and that was great. And we just kind of ran out of steam, and then I started my own one, and I did with 98 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I had Beryl on it, which is great. It's a great episode. And then Andy Best, who runs the Dungeons and Dragons podcast. I kind of, you know, I help them get that going and help produce that. And so, and then we did a lot of video podcasts as well for this show called The Gathering, which is kind of like, I had a professional comedian living here for like 10 months, a guy named Butch Bradley. And he had a show where he would bring interesting people from around the city and they would be interviewed and then perform or do whatever their thing was. And we would film that and put it out as video and audio. So yeah, 4 podcasts. It's a couple.
So you got the 98 episodes. You didn't want to round that off?
I don't know, man. I
didn't drive you nuts.
I hit a wall.
Yeah.
In a big way. And the last 6 months have been pretty crazy as well for me. Because I did Eddie Izzard, and then the Melbourne Festival, and then the China Festival, and then Russell Howard, and then my wife had a baby, and I was like, I don't have time for this. I did a bunch of interviews but when you do an interview that doesn't work, it's really demoralizing, especially because I was on a weekly schedule, and then I got to try and record another one, and it just becomes this massive headache, and you're up until like 3 a.m. on a Sunday night, just like, why am I doing this? So it was a lot of that, and I was just like, I need to take a break.
Yeah, but you probably met some very interesting people.
Yeah, tons.
Do you have any guests that were favorites or?
Beryl was one.
Aww.
And also the worst. No. She just talked about asbestos the whole time. Very unusual.
My favorites. Okay.
Yeah, she's like Elvis and asbestos. That was it. We had
disaster episodes?
I mean, you know, there were tons of disaster... Well, no, there weren't tons of disaster episodes.
What's your favorite disaster?
There were no favorites. Disasters are not fun. I really, as an artist, I really like putting stuff out.
Yeah.
I like finishing stuff. I understand my friends who are artists, who are creative, that can't put stuff out. And I realize that is just the biggest failing as an artist, is to just not be able to, like, put your ego aside and just get it out there. And so anything that stands in the way of that, it really is stressful. You know,
A bomb interview is worse than bombing for you on stage?
Well, because the consequences are bigger. You know, it will take me hours to redo the interview. But bombing on stage is just, you know, it happens every week.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not...
And you're like, that's done. On to the next one.
I don't like bombing. I'm not saying I enjoy it. Well, sometimes it's fun, but usually it's a horrid experience. But you just go, all right, I'm going to get on the next show and wash that taste out of my mouth. It's an easier fix. Depends how bad the bomb is. you know, I had one interview that was very interesting. I interviewed a Nigerian drug dealer.
All
right. Yeah, one of the comedians was like, you should interview one of these Nigerian drug dealers. I'm like, I don't know how I would start up asking for that. And he's like, you can ask my drug dealer. I already asked him. He said he'd do it. And so
I just like how it's like, you should interview a Nigerian drug dealer. Okay. It's like, I have a guy for you, actually, if you want to get into that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a
scene. But you have to text him at 2 a.m. and you have to buy something. No, he was like, the funny thing about it was that he was like, this guy's a former drug dealer. And then immediately into the interview, it was obvious that he was not a former drug dealer. He was a current drug dealer. I think the worst part of that whole interview was like, because I did it actually same what I did with you, is I was, had a couple of Airbnb things, right? So I had this Airbnb apartment that the Nolan was in for the night. I didn't want to bring this guy back to our house. My wife just got upset when we start doing loads of blow all over the table. No. And he was, so when we finished, he like goes, I need to use your bathroom. And I'm standing in the hallway and I just listened to him piss all over the floor of the bathroom. And then I had to make him wait in the hallway while I went back in and cleaned up this fucking floor for this piece of shit. You know? Like, I don't care if you deal drugs, but you just pissed all over the floor. Like, is there no, even, is there no level of respect?
So high, man.
I'm avoiding the, like, huge dick joke here.
It's like, and only half of our Airbnb residents got robbed after that.
Wow, I'm not gonna... Was he a robber? He wasn't a bad person.
No.
He was, it was a little bit of a tragic story, you know, because you know, these guys, they just, him in particular, he wasn't like he was dropping out of university to become a drug dealer, you know.
I was gonna say, like, I wouldn't even think about that. Is it like a story of, like, he kind of gets, like, thrown into this?
Well, the first thing is that, like, you know, talking to him, it isn't like talking to you or I.
Yeah.
Like, you're talking to someone and he's answering questions, but a lot of his answers don't make any sense. And he's trying to explain to you how he feels about things, but it doesn't all... You're always like, okay, you know. So, for example, like, he came to China because he was very good at soccer.
Mm.
And he thought he'd be able to play in a soccer team here. And he looked like an athlete, like he could be an athlete. I don't know how good he was. I don't know what level he played at, but he was very genuinely thought that he could be a soccer player here, professional soccer player. And he said he arrived and upon arrival learnt that he legally couldn't sign a contract even if he was good enough.
Yeah.
And he was like, it was devastating, you know. And so suddenly this guy's here and he doesn't have any money and he's and everyone he knows is dealing drugs, you know. So he had, that was the only option that he knew of to make money. You know, and I'm not, I don't judge, you know, I have no judgment for someone dealing drugs that can, at his level, you know, for sure. I had huge amounts of sympathy for what seemed like a hard life.
Yeah.
Like, his life did not seem easy. And, you know, and it was a while ago, so I don't fully remember the whole story. And the other thing was, he had such a strong accent, like, a lot of the answers, I just couldn't make out what he was saying, you know what I mean? But it was really, like, and he had this whole story about how he went home and married a woman, and, like, 10 minutes into the story, it turned out the woman was, like, 91. And I was like, did you just say 91? 91. Like, almost 100 years. And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, what? And so, it was kind of a tragic story, I guess. But, you know, interesting insight into, ironically, not that much more sad than a lot of the stories people have here.
That's a great story that maybe was not delivered.
Right. I feel like people, it's funny because fans of the podcast, they messaged me afterwards saying, like, this is what he said when you couldn't understand him, you idiot. Right. And there were some things that I'd missed that were quite interesting, you know?
Yeah.
I think the other thing that's interesting with that, especially, is this, like, how many times do you think he's told this story? Probably not a lot. And it's just,
he
like,
had,
this,
he this wanted is just to,
some guy that, like, has these crazy stories.
He wanted to tell the story.
Yeah.
And part of it was him, like, the sell for him was, like, you've got these great stories, man. The world should know your stories.
Yeah.
And that really resonated with him. But, like, stuff that I wanted to know about, like, where it's coming from or, like, how is it being made, you know, the answers were just so weird. I couldn't really make, like...
I'm sure he's,
like, it felt like
smart
at one minute,
about it. He wants to keep it
he's on another planet of, like, speaking, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's, like, a language thing or a cultural thing, but they just weren't... I wasn't getting the clear answers that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you just kind of had to ride the wave a little bit and be like, well, this is what this is going to be like, this interview.
Well, I'm sure, like, I mean, mean, I'm sure as someone who, you know, talks for a living, you are quite critical of, like, the way that those stories are conveyed and stuff. I don't know, I mean, I was watching a David Blaine TED Talk. I hate David Blaine.
It's an unusual man to hate.
I don't know, I just think he's... You know, like,
I just wish he'd disappear. Hey.
Whoa. Like a lot of people hate
him. Tune in this Saturday. So he was talking about, like, training his body in order to stay underwater for these extended periods of time. It was actually a really fascinating talk, but I just hate his cadence. I mean, yeah. Like, I can't.
That's great.
To the guy.
I love that.
That's been his thing. Like, everyone hates him. It's like, why? It's like, I don't know. It's like Chris Angel, where it's just like. It's just some bad of it's just like, yeah.
Well,
so douchey,
you know, one
like,
thing I've learned, I think, in stand-up is that people really have an energy that they're putting out there, and people that are performers tend to be open enough that you can identify what that energy is mm-hmm. pretty easily, and sometimes you don't like that energy.
Yeah.
And once you don't like it, you can't listen to anything that they have yeah. to say, and I see that all the time. And you know, what's interesting is that energy can change from show to show, even in front of people that already know the person. If they start yeah. putting out the wrong thing, the crowd can just be like, just depart from them entirely.
Yeah. And that's like, kind of go back to, not even just the person, what you're saying about the room, that like, feel, I mean, I'm not in comedy, but just listening to so many comedian podcasts and them talking about it, it's like, the smallest little things can change how people react to someone. Like, they could tell the exact same joke, but in a different room it doesn't work. If you say one thing before it, it, like, changes the whole...
Yeah, like, if you are doing... Like, there was a comic last night doing... Misha Kalin was doing jokes that were, like, kind of negative about Chinese women, and he thought it wasn't. And you see, immediately your reaction, right?
Yeah.
And... But as a comic, it's just a joke. It's just a twist. But the topics are influencing the reaction.
Yeah.
So when he was seen to be negative in the setup, and then the punchline was negative, the crowd just turned away from him. And I'm like, you can't. You
got to reword it.
Well, that just doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, there's the counterpoint to that is that, like, the element of reveal can override how people think about things. Like, for example, like, you see a comedian who you think is about to say something nice about children, and then he says he fucking hates them. Is that a good thing? Do you defend children? Or is it just you didn't see it coming, so the element of surprise caused you to laugh before you could think about what was being said? There's aspects like that
mm-hmm.
to think about.
I'm sure chemistry is even more important when you're doing these, like, one-on-one podcast interviews.
Yeah, there's some people that just, you know, I mean, Darshan was the first interview that I did on Stuck in the Middle, and he just speaks, you know, you just get out of his way. And I was like, man, this is easy. And I think the next one, the person, like two or three later, I did my friend Drew, who's like one of my closest friends, you know, and he had, usually at that time, I needed to have something we were going to talk about. I was a little less confident. And so he said he was going to pick something but not tell me. And halfway through the interview, he lost all confidence and decided to not talk about it. So then we had this whole conversation where I was trying to get him to talk about something I didn't know what it was, and he wasn't talking about it. And halfway through, I was like, I need to turn the microphones off.
Was this like too personal or like...
He never told me what the thing was. I think he forgot. but it was horrible.
Yeah.
And I was like, after that, I was like, wow, this is... A lot harder than I didn't even have chemistry with one of my closest friends, you know what I mean? We're not friends anymore. No.
I feel like the other hard part would be, I mean, people, some of them probably a little more than others that you're interviewing, they're not like quote unquote famous or big, so it's like you can't even do like research on them. Like, so, you know, it's almost hard to do a lot of like pre-interview setup because there's not much there to go off of.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think as you get better at it, you can carry it. You know, you don't need to have so much structure. But if the person is on there for a reason, then you should know about that reason.
Mm-hmm.
At least enough that you can have a conversation with them about it.
Yeah.
Like, if you've got a guy that's on there because he built Shin Tian D, you got to mention that at some point. Otherwise, why did you have him on there?
Yeah. But even just, I mean, I think just the presence of the microphone, like, changes that chemistry so much. Some people, like, really lock up.
Depends on the people, yeah.
Yes, of course, yeah. But, I mean, for example, like, the 60-second life story, like, that's something that I've done at bars for years and years and years, just to, like, sort of, like, bypass the whole get-to-know-you game, you know? And what's really interesting about it is how people respond. Like, some people think about the time only, and they totally lock up. And they just go, well, I was born here, and now I moved to China, and I do this. And that's it. That's the whole story.
Stop.
Yeah. They just, like, completely, like, panic.
Yeah.
And then other people, they launch into this thing, then it becomes, like, an hour-long conversation. Mm-hmm. Also, it's, like, interesting how they prioritize the things that have happened in their life. Some people, like, really focus on, like, their childhood. Some people only talk about their professional life. But I think all of those things are, like, enlightening about who they are. You know what I mean?
Sure. I do.
I actually just thought of something I wanted to ask you. With kind of going back, I guess the David Blaine thing reminded me. With working with comedians in, it is, you know, it's like an art, it's a performance. And I always think about this going back to art school of, like, do you have a weird connection with people where you know them as their person and know their, like, stage presence and, like, dealing with, oh, I like this guy, but I hate his comedy, or vice versa. It's like, ah, I wish that guy wasn't so good because I don't like him as a person. Or do you think with stand-up it just all bleeds together and it's hard to separate the two?
I've never liked the comedy of someone that I didn't like.
Yeah.
But I have, you know, what's more common is that it's tough for me as the booker for the club, because there are people that come through that I do really like as people, but if they're not funny, then they're gonna at some point be like, why aren't you putting me on shows? And people,
you have to be the boss.
People, if you tell, if you have to judge someone on the quality of their art, and you have to, that's what it is, it's unavoidable. You either put everyone on or you pass judgment on whether they've met a standard or not, and people are very quick to take it personally as an attack on them rather than you saying that they're not ready or anything like that. And I try to be conscious of that, but it has been very difficult for me to maintain friendships with people that aren't really doing well enough on stage who have that aspiration. But with professionals, you know what? There's a couple of guys who are dicks off stage, but I can still enjoy their comedy if it's really funny.
Yeah.
There's one guy. He's so fucking funny. And he would be famous if he wasn't such a huge dick. But he's such a fucking asshole.
I feel like you'd have to hear the comedy first before you get to know him.
Maybe. But he's so funny that it just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, he did a show in Suzhou, and I stepped out of the room for a minute, and he just blew up at this girl in the front row. He started calling her a cunt, demanding that she leave the room, and just blasting this girl for, like, 2 minutes straight. Wow. Yeah, and this girl was in total shock. You could see she was just, like, frozen solid. She couldn't move for, like, the rest of the show. Anyway, he turns around to the crowd. He's like, I bet you're wondering how I'm going to get out of this hole.
Yeah.
And then just murders for, like, 20 minutes.
Really?
And finishes. And then after the show, so I went around. I said, everyone told me what had happened. I went around. I said, guys, look, here's your refund, your ticket. I'm really sorry. Let me get you a drink. She was just melting down. She just, as soon as she was able to move, she just started bawling. Everyone in the room was trying to talk to her. She's like, I just need to get out of here. It was horrible.
Yeah.
So then I go back to the guy and I was like trying to find out what he thought had happened.
Yeah.
Right. And from everyone's account, she had not done anything. She had a slightly unusual laugh.
Oh my gosh.
Right. So I go to the guy and I was like, hey man, what happened? And he goes, oh, fucking hecklers, man. It's fucking hecklers. I'm not going to put up with it anymore. You know? I'm not taking hecklers. And I just go, did she heckle? What did she say? Like, genuine question. And he goes, well, she didn't really heckle, but like, she was so drunk, she didn't know what was going on. And I said, well, I spoke to her. She's not drinking. So, and he just blew up at me. And the guy didn't talk to me for like 3 days.
Wow.
He's like, two-year-old, like walking past me without looking at me. And I found out later that he does this like all the time, you know, but he's amazing. He's got a Netflix special. Guy's named Pete Johansson. Phenomenal comic. Funniest closing joke I think I've ever heard. And I would never book him again though. You know, but it was just, it was this weird, like, and then the next night someone was in the front row taking a phone call and he goes, are you taking a phone call? And everyone in the back of the room that knew what happened was like, oh God! And he just handled it like a professional, and we're just like, oh, you know, super stressful.
Yeah, I can picture there being a bit that's a.
Like, but I still laugh. I still tell people like his yeah. joke. So I'd say his joke. This is his joke. Okay. It's not my joke. But he had this story about how he'd been. I probably shouldn't tell his joke because I just ripped on him. But
people can go look.
It's funny. He's on Netflix. Don't watch his shit.
We can cut that email.
Do you find you deal with a lot of comedians, whether they're, you know, experienced here, like regulars or new people, that they get up and like they know comedy from like what they hear, what they see, and like they. When anyone in the crowd, like, does anything, they feel like, oh, yeah, this is my chance to be, like, fuck this heckler and, like, attack them. And then it's, like, but it's under the guise of, like, well, I'm a comedian. I can do that. But then it's, like, almost, like, unwarranted. Like,
I mean, to be honest, like, I'm very unlikely to side with an audience member.
Yeah.
Don't interrupt the show. If you're watching a comedy show, don't do it. I don't care if you think you're supposed to do it. You're not supposed to do it. I'm so sick of people trying to tell me they think they're supposed to fuck with the show.
Oh, I'm sure that's horrible.
It's the most annoying thing ever. And people have these arguments with me. I'm like, you don't know. I'm telling you. You're
it's
wrong.
It's a performance.
Nobody wants you to do that.
Yeah.
It's not a thing. They're like, yeah, but it's funny. Everyone laughed after I said something and they responded to it. It's like, it's like if you were watching a running race and you fucking threw an obstacle in front of the runner and the runner evaded it because he's a professional and everyone was like, wow, that was interesting to see. Should you do it? You shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know,
you especially shouldn't keep doing it. Oh, like, I feel like that'd be the biggest struggle.
And then they have the arrogance to stand at the bar and just try to convince everyone that they were supposed to do that. And, it just really is annoying.
It's like that old chestnut, like, I don't come to your job and slap the dicks out of your mouth.
Yeah, I mean, like, I wouldn't do that because it's such a hacky line, but, like, it's a bit, like, it's just the arrogant. People come to comedy clubs and they're so fucking arrogant, you know? Because the thing is that, like, there's just, someone pointed this out to me, like, men, this is men I'm talking about right now.
Mm.
There's a dynamic, especially if a man, like, brings a date to a comedy club where there's a guy on stage making their date laugh.
Yeah.
Impressing them, and at some point it's just too much for them,
uh-huh.
and they have to try to be impressive, and it never ends well for them because they're stacking themselves against a professional who's already won the audience over. I've never seen it work out for that guy, but it happens all the time.
Well,
these guys, they come in and they're like, I want to be funny as well. I want to be funny as well. Yeah. It's like, well, come to a show where you're like, supposed to be on the stage, you know. Just because you've had a few too many drinks doesn't mean you're entitled to like disrupt the person on the stage. Because the other thing is that, like, these guys, they're artists as well. They're working on their act.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to work on their material. Their material doesn't involve you.
Yeah.
It's you know, I mean, I have some level of sympathy, but it isn't said explicitly anywhere.
Yeah.
But I lose that sympathy when you tell them and they still disagree with you.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I'm only angry about this because I do it all the time.
Yeah.
And these people are like, well, I saw a show where there was a heckler and everyone thought it was funny.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, but everyone thought the heckler was an idiot.
Mm-hmm. You're always the loser.
You're always the idiot.
But, and I think that goes back to what you were saying, is like, people don't realize actually going to see a stand-up show, most people, like, when they do, it's probably their first time.
Sure, and yeah, that's true.
It's the atmosphere of, like, it's very personal, and they forget it's still a performance.
Well, you know, the
it's
other
still,
thing
like,
is, like, you don't want to, like, you don't want to give people too many rules when they walk in there. But, like, you know, you have to, like, so we sort of were a little bit reactive, and it's harder to give people rules when you're reacting. It's harder to tell people not to do something after they've already started doing it.
Yeah.
You have people bringing food, you know, fucking people bringing, people take phone calls, you know.
What's the wildest audience reaction you've had?
I've had people try to punch the guy on the stage. I've had people grab them. I had a guy grab the microphone off me. Yeah.
For what purpose?
He wanted to tell jokes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He was hammered. He had a bottle of wine in one hand. He looked like Duck Dynasty. He looked like a fucking homeless person. And he had a huge beard, ran on stage, couldn't get the mic off me, started trying to talk to the audience. And it was a really high stage in Hangzhou.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm just going to bump this guy up. I'm just going to give him a little tap. Little tap-a-rooney. Just get him off the stage. And I hit him on a bad angle. He tripped on his own foot. Face planted the table in the front row, rolled off, landed on the acoustic guitar that he had brought, smashing it, And the thing about...
Is this like an open mic or just an event?
No, this is a show. This is a professional... people paid like 150 RMB to go to this show. This fucking clown walks on stage, blackout drunk.
Yeah.
And...
Can you get back up?
The thing is that, like, when you're on stage, you cannot show genuine anger. If people think that you're actually angry, they will turn away from you.
Yeah.
They don't want to get behind the angry guy. So there was this moment where they couldn't see me. It looked like I'd thrown this guy, like a cartoon, like hand on the back of the pants, hand on the back of the neck, you know. And I'm there like, hey, still, I'm the fucking opener. Some guy's going to come up and do an hour after me. And this room has turned into a bar fight where people are being thrown on instruments.
Yeah, the comedians hate you.
And I'm like, hey. Anyway, so we kind of managed that. And it's now like a famous story in that bar, in that show. But, you know, one other thing that, like, I don't know, like, I was a big drinker for years, and I don't drink anymore, but I just got to a point now where people think that when they drink, they can just dump their behavior on strangers, and I really don't like that. I'm like, you know what? I get that you're relaxing. I get that you're having a night out, but I'm relaxing as well, and I don't want to have to deal with you. I don't want to have to deal with your shit, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. I'm like, just handle your shit.
It forgets the performance. And then I would assume a lot of it is what you're saying is like, I'm the funny guy, where it's like, these are people who, like, you know, in their head, they're like, oh, people tell me I'm funny all the time and I want to do this, but they don't have, you know, for lack of a better word, the balls to go do it. Like, as a normal performer, maybe their upbringing, they were never like in a performing situation or whatever. And then they get a few drinks, and it's just like,
oh, yeah.
It's like, I could, like, they picture themselves like winning the room and being like the
they
hero.
They do. That's the thing.
Like,
that's the thing. Is if it's a really, it's a really good show,
yeah,
they will listen to this. There's a beat going on.
Yeah.
He speaks, they laugh. He speaks, they laugh. He speaks, they laugh. He's like, if I speak, they're gonna laugh. But you have to be funny to have that. They just kind of lose that very key element in there. I don't mean to just... Now I'm kind of ranting and complaining. No. But like, it's just lately as well. We keep throwing people out. It's driving me insane. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. This guy is sitting in the front row, falls asleep, talking loud, takes a phone call, talking, sleep, wakes up, just starts talking to the comedian. Yeah. And the comedian, professional, like this guy was in, you know, Will Cervantes, he was in Chris Rock's movie, House MC from the Comedy Show. This guy's a big comedian. And he says, hey, man, I'll refund your ticket. You got to get out. You can't sit in the front row like this anymore. So I'm running the room. I got to get him out. I can't argue with the comedian who's halfway through his show.
Yeah.
I have to eject this person, right? So I bring him out, and he's like, he's like, I'm tired. I was on a flight. I'm like, you're blackout drunk. Just own it, you know? You're an adult.
Yeah.
Who are you lying to? How stupid do you think we are?
Like, on that, again, I'm sure if he was that wasted, it's like just obliviousness, but it's just like...
But hang on, like, so he comes out, right? His wife...
Oh, wow, the story's not over.
That's the beginning of the story. The beginning of the story. So I finally convinced this guy that what he did wasn't appropriate. You can't sit in the front row and do that. It's not okay. So he eats it, and it's fine. And then his wife, who has been enjoying the show, the rest of the show, with her friends, is like having a blast. Sees her husband, and is like... They just come over and yell at me. They're like, once we're going to get on WeChat, no foreigners will ever come back to this show. You're making all these threats, you know? And I'm just there like, okay, you know, fine. I refunded their tickets, right?
Yeah.
This guy's so fucking... Like, he wasn't even that drunk. He was just an idiot. He in gesticulating, he punched a woman in the face.
Whoa,
yeah.
Oh my God.
He just threw his hand back, just punched a girl in the face. And then they get up the next day and they're like, we're going to crush your business. Can you refund our tickets? I'm like, I refunded your tickets. You already have money for your tickets.
Case and point to how drunk you were.
Yeah, right? You tell me you were sleepy. You don't remember getting your money back.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, it's just like, I mean, I guess it sounds like maybe the wife dragged him along. But it's like, and these people, it's like, why are you in the front row? And why are you, like, here? It's like,
she goes to me, she goes, you know what? You need to understand that in my life, there's my husband and my kids. And I just wanted to say to her, I was like, are your kids as fucking annoying as your husband?
I think, it's just like, these people must have just never been told no or something.
That's it,
man. And then they get defensive where it's just like...
Expats living in China, they have not enough rules around them. Yeah. They forget that you have to treat people around you with a level of respect. Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine what they're like to the people they work with. You know, God damn, imagine working with that person every day.
Yeah, and then it's like, just beyond that, where if the wife comes up, it's just like, she has to now turn into like,
yeah,
defensive
like,
mode. Is just
I'm like, can't you just own it? Can you just be like, yeah,
like,
you
just
know
be
what?
Like, I'm sorry.
I would
like,
be so humiliated, you know? I'd be like,
at that point, I just feel like it's survival mechanism.
Yeah. I would go home.
That's what I mean. It's like, you have two choices.
You feel so guilty, so you just like lean into it, I guess. And, like,
I must say, you know what's funny? I, for some reason, I do really find it hilarious when people double down.
Yeah.
It's just the funniest thing when they're so far in the wrong, they just go again. You know, like I was at a wedding, right, and I couldn't find a car park for 20 minutes. Finally, find a car park, and as I'm pulling into it, this car goes the wrong way across a massive intersection, wrong way of the road, dives in front of me, and we're just like, fuck. And then the person in the passenger seat just gives me the bed. And I was like, that's pretty funny. And then they were going to the same wedding. They were sitting behind us.
Oh my God. Did you give the finger back?
The person, I sit down, the person goes, why are you late? And I go, because the fucking cunt behind me stole my seat, like stole my park. And now they're like, yeah, fair enough.
They've cooled down on that one. Well, that's always one of my favorite stories. My friend, they used to be in a band, and their tour van was this like airport shuttle, like one of those almost small buses, and they used to drive that around, and they used to drive like through New York, and my one friend loved New York, you know, this was right out of university, but, and the other kids in the band were all from New Jersey, they all hate New York, and like, we'd be driving through, and he's a super aggressive driver, because he has this giant fucking bus that it's like, what are you gonna threaten me, like, and like, the kid was like, I fucking hate New York, how do you like driving in this shit, because it's bumper to bumper, it's super aggressive, and he's just like, I love New York because you can do whatever the fuck you want. Watch, I'm gonna cut this guy off. And he's like, because I can do this, and like cuts this guy off and just holds the horn down for like a full minute, like absurd. He's like, you just cut that guy off, and he's like, yeah, and then I honked him. Like it's just like, yeah, I'm an asshole. I'm gonna be an asshole. It's just like, oh my God.
Wow.
I'm just that super aggressive. But...
How are we doing on time?
I gotta get out of here.
Alright, we'll let you go. Thank you, Andy, for coming in.
Dude, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
We had a great time. And
podcasting train.
We'll probably mention it in the intro, but of course, check out Kung Fu Comedy and check out his old podcast.
Thank you, yeah.
Maybe you'll come back for episodes 99 and 100.
I'm hoping to do it. In like 10 years' time, I'll do it.
Yeah.
The last two.
10-year anniversary.
When I was 16, I bought my first Mercedes Benz. I must have fucked 1,000 bitches and a girlfriend. White leather, hot new pair of rims, brand new pistol with a trigger like a hairpin. Big work, we don't need a scale, man. Big paper, say good morning to the mailman. What you know about putting